Campus FM presents a talk organized by the Office of the President of Malta entitled A Renaissance Palace in the Making. This talk is delivered by Dr. Therese Vella.
Good evening, ladies and gentlemen. Thank you for coming. Also, this time, this penultimate lecture, Dr. Therese Vella of the Baroque International Studies of the University of Malta, who is also a very important position in the regeneration of this palace. And, of course, we are going to regenerate not the palace, but our thoughts about the palace. As you made a special study on this palace, and I hope, like all the other lectures, that you'll enjoy this evening's one-hour talk. Dr. Therese Vella.
First of all, thank you very much, Mr. Moussou, and to the President's office for inviting me to give this talk. It's rather exciting for me to actually be inside this hall and talking, including about the frescoes above our heads, because they were really the first introduction I had to the study about this palace over 10 years ago, with my studies for the MA in Baroque Studies. And these frescoes have kept calling me back. There's something about them that rewards further study. But really, my interest in this palace grew again with my recent doctoral research on the history of art collecting amongst Hospitaller knights. Because really, you can't study art collections without understanding even their context, the spaces within which they were displayed. You'd also need to understand who would see these paintings and what were the messages they'd communicate to the viewer. Really, there's a whole story to be told around art collecting, patronage, and the display of art without even starting to consider, if you like, the genius of the artist, which is the more traditional art history that we're familiar with. A Renaissance palace in the making. What's Renaissance about this palace, besides the fact that it was built in the 16th century, the century of the High Renaissance? There's a lot about it, in fact, but it hasn't ever really been tackled holistically. The palace has always been a bit of a, well, country cousin, we could say, to St. John's Crook Cathedral, which has enjoyed the constant accumulation of treasures inside it, and its dazzling nature has also caught people's attention over the centuries. Whereas this palace, for various reasons, hasn't always been so publicly visible. And in a way, I think its invisibility has been its part of the reason why we don't know as much about it as we do about the more public spaces and the churches of the Order of St. John. The palace is really a reflection now of the values that underpinned Renaissance culture. The difficulty is that we tend to consider the Renaissance in terms of Italian art history. It's been discussed in terms of the Medici Dukes' self-aggrandizement, in a way, their promotion of the arts and so on. But really, the Renaissance has been studied much deeper and seemed to have started much earlier in Burgundy. The Dukes of Burgundy, particularly Philip the Good and Charles the Bold, in the beginning of the 15th century, had already started studying classical culture, started buying ancient texts for various reasons, primarily, though, to teach themselves the art of good governance. And with these teachings came other values that can be seen to go back even to the times, to the teachings of Aristotle, where the magnificence and splendor were part of the identity of a good governor. Investing, if you like, or spending one's money on public monuments or artifacts which had a function, for example, like altarpieces or religious performances, for example, musical performances. That was part of the exchange, if you like, between a good governor, a good ruler, and his people, the ruled. After Aristotle, other philosophers like Cicero, for example, expressed now how it was actual craftsmanship that was part. Investing in craftsmanship, finely crafted objects, was also part of the expression of magnificence and splendor in things, because it was a way of encouraging excellence in crafts, possibly part even of promoting the economy as well, but mostly in terms of the excellence of craftsmanship being something to be proud of, not simply in terms of the person who's paying for it, but even in terms of the community that's creating it and collectively, in a way, sharing it. Later, theologians in the 13th century underpinned these values with Christian values, the sense of magnificence, now liberality, being part now of the Christian leader's responsibility to his people. And Burgundy, by the way, is a part of France, very close to Paris, but where this the court culture of the Dukes of Burgundy was particularly magnificent. The investment in tapestries showing, for example, the life of Alexander or Julius Caesar, would allow the patron, in this case the dukes, to assimilate their own identity with that of the narratives of the stories that were illustrating the fine work of tapestry. We know that tapestry is particularly labor-intensive and very expensive. The Dukes of Burgundy also invested in seeking ancient texts for other reasons, because ancient texts allowed them not simply to observe good governance, but also allowed them to observe and discover narratives with which to pepper their own oratorial skills, with which to communicate their own ideas to people. So this erudition became part now of the Renaissance person's self-identity. The court of the Dukes of Burgundy was particularly famed throughout Europe, especially amongst other courts that were eager to imitate, to emulate them, like the court of the Valois court of Francis I, but more particularly now the Medici Dukes themselves, who were eager. They're being merchant people, not of noble extraction, they were twice as eager, if you like, to appropriate the methods of Renaissance Burgundian dukes for the creation of their own identity now as leaders of their own people. With the Italian Renaissance, though, it takes on a slightly different flavor. The Italian Renaissance, we know that works of art, for example, were particularly promoted amongst Italian artists, who at first started imitating the Netherlandish artists like Jan van Eyck or Rogier van der Weyden. That exactitude, that delight in a naturalistic representation, was something that Italian artists like Piero della Francesca actually got from artists in the courts of the Dukes of Burgundy. By the end of the 15th century, Italian artists, Italian patrons now evolved their own form of patronage. Because after all, classical texts, classical sculptures, classical works of art, classical architecture, that was homegrown for Italian artists and architects. So there's a form of appropriation now that happens there. We also know, though, that our knowledge of the history of art is really shaped by what an author, Giorgio Vasari, actually wrote in the middle of the 16th century, where he wrote a book, basically a series of biographies of Italian artists, in a way building up the biographical importance of Italian artists, emphasizing their genius, the genius of artists like Leonardo da Vinci, Michelangelo, and so on, with a really patriotic purpose, in a way all part of the striving, the competitive rivalry, if you like, that arts and architecture also, in their own way, had as a subtext. So it's in this scenario, okay, that within this cultural, rich cultural scenario, that the Knights of St. John grew up in. We know that the Knights of St. John came from all over Europe. This is just a short sketch, really. I'm sorry, it's a bit faint, really. But all the dots in the different countries show the commanderies that belonged to the Order of St. John, where the knights who were responsible for the commanderies would earn, if you like, money off the rents. But there were also priorates throughout Europe. We think of the Order of St. John as exclusively concerned with its headquarters in Malta. But the geographic formamentis of the Order of St. John is something that we need to pay more attention to. This pan-European perspective is something that was constantly present in the mind, certainly of the leading knights, but certainly in the minds of the Grand Master. When Valletta was planned, even before the time of the Great Siege, actually, there was the first thought of Baldassarre Lanci to build the palace more or less in the site where it is today. But Francesco Laparelli, whose plans for the fortification of Valletta were the most important ones, had actually proposed that the palace be built where the Auberge de Castille is today, the office of the Prime Minister. However, circumstances, the fact that when the Order of St. John moved from Burgo to Valletta, the current Grand Master at the time, Pietro di Monte, chose to spend some time living in the property that was originally that of his nephew, Eustache del Monte, which is right where we're standing today. And Pietro del Monte decided to go back to Lanci's plans for the location of the palace, back in the centre of the city. So rather than a more medieval type of location for the Grand Master's palace, the heights, the highest most part of Valletta, really, of the promontory, which is where Castile is today, aloof, if you like, from the rest of the city. Instead, Pietro di Monte decided, no, the centre of the city is where the palace is supposed to be. And that is a most Renaissance idea. The fact of the palace now being in the heart of the city, we can see that it's on the main axis of Valletta, on Strada Reale, even within sight of both Fort St. Elmo at one end and of Porta Reale, the main entrance to Valletta, at the other end. So we start seeing now a sort of relationship happening here between a palace that is seen, that's highly visible on the main thoroughfare, but also has a very commanding position to oversee the rest of the town itself. The beginning of the palace, really, as I mentioned earlier, started with the residence of Eustachio di Monte. Just to recap very briefly, the site where the palace is on today was not originally meant to be that for the palace. It was actually divided into three other plots. Half of the site on the left, belonged at first to the Lung of Italy. And in fact, the Lung of Italy had already built its auberge, its first floor, when Eustachio di Monte had his own house as well on the other side. Besides the auberge on the left, there were two private residences on the right. The Eustachio di Monte one in the corner that we're seeing today, and between the di Monte and the Lung of and the auberge, there was another residence belonging to two knights, both of them Borgia knights. Their name is Borgia. Now, with this, we're really only seeing a shadow of what Pietro di Monte lived in, really, but the traces are still there. The third window on the ground floor, as we're seeing here, is actually bang in the middle, and that is probably where the first door, the main entrance, was to the di Monte residence. If not the di Monte residence, certainly that moment when Grandmaster di Monte had started occupying now the right-hand side and had his property along that half of the block. At the moment, there's a window. The door was blocked up. But I'm only going to be covering the first, if you like, 3 decades of the existence of this palace. So otherwise, it will take a very long time to just go over all the changes that this palace went through. This is a 17th century drawing that draws us a bit closer to what the palace looked like then. And in a way, it communicates this idea of it being part of something. It hasn't grown, the palace didn't grow as one holistic entity. And as we're seeing in this drawing by William Schellings, the Dutch artist who was in Malta around 1664, we can see that the palace still had 2 levels. Okay? This was the time, though, when before the palace was designed as we're seeing it today. As we're seeing today, its final look was acquired in the 18th century. But for a long time, the palace kept this sort of half-finished appearance to it. This is a drawing. This is just a sketch, by the way. It's simply the fact that the cornice of the palace was stepped and kept re-emphasizing this sort of dual nature of the palace and the way it was constructed. We also know that the right-hand side of the palace for a long time had what we would consider as a Renaissance garden. It's a very, even the space itself has sort of the dimensions of a residence, unlike the lower courtyard, which has the dimensions of an auberge, really, which is a much more larger communal kind of space. The right-hand side of the palace still has this feeling to it in terms of its dimensions. Now, this is a drawing, a watercolor, of an album compiled by one of the engineers of the order who was responsible for the water works and the arrival of, the way water reached Valletta from the Rabat area. But it's still very evocative, even though it's just a sketch. The way the garden spaces are very symmetrically divided, but there's still sort of a fairly decorative element in the way even those, each quarter is divided, subdivided into other smaller patches. We don't have much information about this garden, so we would need to arrive at its understanding, its final design, if one understands now Renaissance gardens. But chances are there would have been an area for the growth of herbs, for example, but there would also have been flowers giving off scents. The Renaissance period was also a time now when the senses were rediscovered, for lack of a better word, in terms when this is when now a higher quality of life started seeping in, started first being enjoyed by the Grand Master, but then eventually as the culture would spread, if you like, exponentially. So you'd have the importance of scents. We also know, for example, that there was an aviary in the palace around this time. So you'd have these sounds, these musical sounds of birds. They're all things, though, that we need our imagination to be able to evoke. The Renaissance garden lasted well into the 19th century, when it was radically changed. We know from watercolours by Brockdorff that the garden was changed by the insertion of an old tennis court, a proper tennis court, and later on, 1860s, the garden as it is today, sort of partly botanical, but different, completely different arrangement to what we're seeing in this other sketch, in this other watercolour. Now, this is an 18th century plan of Valletta, but I introduce this picture to show you, one, the garden, that it still retained its Renaissance proportions, but more importantly now, for the next phase that remained. Now, the phase that was initiated by the next Grand Master, Jean de la Cassière. Jean de la Cassière succeeded Del Monte and was rather more anxious than Del Monte to get the Magistral Palace going. It took him a long time to get the Italian knights out. It took him about 5 or 6 years. But it's very likely that he may have started building over the auberge before that as a means to kind of get them to get their act together. All this has been very well described in other publications. I should acknowledge, in fact, the importance of a book by that was published by Fondazione Patrimonio Malti, On the Palace of the Grand Master, edited by Albert Ganado, that was a first and still seminal attempt at understanding not just the architecture of the palace, but even the way life unfolded within the palace. And I urge you to get your hands on a copy of that book if you still manage to find one. But La Cassière, the different changes that occurred with La Cassière's magistry, are primarily now the room that we're standing in. La Cassière created the staircase that is circled in the drawing, a sort of parallel line, dogleg staircase, that connected the ground floor of the Di Monte residence together with the Piano Nobile. This was now de La Cassière establishing a proper Renaissance Piano Nobile. Now, when I say Renaissance, it encompasses really the High Renaissance. In art historical terms, we're moving into Mannerist art here. But still, Mannerist art is part of the High Renaissance, as we understand it in art and architectural terms. Now, when La Cassière built this floor, he was really aspiring now to create a palace that was worthy of representing a great order, the Hospitaller Order of St. John. The La Cassière understood perfectly well the importance of being seen to be having a splendid surroundings. We must remember Lacassier was the person who actually paid for St. John's Co-Cathedral, the conventual church. He was also the man who paid for the first building of this Piano Nobile. Lacassier understood the background and competing, if you like, in establishing rivalry with other princes of Europe in trying to capture the attention of other kings, dukes, in seeking their support for the fortification program of the Order for Falletta. The Grand Master of the Order of St. John was constantly aware of his counterparts, his peers in mainland Europe. And this is why the need to establish a palace on the same footing as other palaces in Europe. Lacassier was possibly also emulating the palace that the Order actually had in Rhodes. We know that Pierre d'Aubusson had a grand palace in Rhodes, but not enough attention has been given now to how that palace was embellished. Because, again, one lacuna in what we know about the Order of St. John is caused by the fact that attention has been given to its religious and its military character. The more private lifestyles, for example, the more private artifacts that were everyday things of one's life haven't yet been given that much visibility. The reason also is that those artifacts would often be dispersed because of the statutory requirements of the Order of St. John. But I'm just trying to explain the gap. For a long time, we've had this idea that becoming a knight of the Order of St. John in the 16th century, in the wake of the success of the 1480 siege in Rhodes, in the wake of the loss of Rhodes, and in the wake of the success of the Great Siege, there's this constant idea that the Order of St. John was a bit of a cultural desert. We must keep in mind that, still, that men of letters, Spanish, French, Italian men of letters, would aspire to belong to the Order of St. John. The best known are Pietro Bembo, for example, or Pietro Aretino. What was it about the Order of St. John that we're missing here? So I think that's the next stage for research now into the history of hospitaller culture. And that's still waiting to be pieced together. You can actually ignore the slide because we're inside the very room itself. Now, when de Lacassier built this room, for quite a few years, actually, it was one huge cavernous barn, we could say. He was trying hard to get a good artist from mainland Italy to Malta. And he succeeded in attracting Matteo Perez d'Alecchio, who was in Malta around by 1577. And he was engaged on producing now the first major secular decorative cycle for the Order of St. John. And we're very familiar with these. We know that these are the history of the Great Siege. But it's worth recalling now what de Lacassier was trying to emulate. In mainland Italy, in Tuscany particularly, we know of similar cycles where victories, for example, of the Medici, were depicted by Giorgio Vasari inside Palazzo Vecchio. So that's one comparative element to understand now why the Great Siege itself was a chosen subject. It's not necessarily automatically assumed. It could have easily been a series of portraits of previous grandmasters, as we know in the Doge's Palace in Venice, for example. But anyway, the point of comparison was with Palazzo Vecchio. It's also very interesting as well that the depiction of the Great Siege isn't a series of episodes where the cartographic element is almost more important, more present than the narrative of the Great Siege itself. Now, this is interesting because the Great Siege, the narrative itself, starts with that panel over there, with the map of Malta, right, showing the Great Fleet arriving. And with each, as one progresses into reading the frescoes, one sort of starts zooming in to the composition, into the narrative. And if you would care to turn around 180 degrees to see that particular one, you'll see that Perez d'Alecchio's invention draws us into the thick of the action. There is a hint of, well, the plan of Malta in the background, but that is where the composition takes us into the thick of the action. You can turn around again and continue seeing the rest of the frescoes. because by the time we get around to this fresco, now the cartographic element starts coming out again. Matteo Perez da Leccio starts zooming out until the last fresco behind me, the withdrawal of the Turkish fleet, which is back again to being a map of Malta. Now, this is a unique invention. I have yet to come across a similar idea, the sort of cyclical, zooming in and zooming out again, reading of a set of pictures. You can only discuss it in cinematographic terms, as I've just mentioned, zooming in and zooming out. And it's extraordinarily inventive. And, well, this is, if you like, part now of the Renaissance idea of an artist's invention, an artist's genius being allowed to come out. It's difficult for us now to ascribe the invention entirely to Matteo Perez da Leccio. We still don't know enough about the artist. What we do know about the artist is his skill in handling the human figure, like the allegories that frame each particular composition. We know that Perez da Leccio was part of Federico Zuccaro's team in Rome in the decoration of the Vatican halls and the papal halls, and we do know that he played a part in depicting similar allegories in Rome. But there's still so much to be discovered. There's a research project waiting to be undertaken on these frescoes alone. But it's also interesting that this is a theme that really creates a great sense of esprit de corps, if you like, about the Knights of St. John, about the Order of St. John. There's really only one major hero depicted here, and that's Jean de Valette over there. But really, it doesn't stand out. The figure of de Valette doesn't really stand out that much. This is about the victory of the Order of St. John and Malta, and Maltese people who were part of the siege themselves. So again, it's a theme that has a collective quality to it. It's not highlighting now one single patron, one single person as a great leader. And possibly this may be, had de La Cassière perhaps been a bit more astute about it, he may not have been deposed as he ended up being. He was a hugely unpopular Grand Master in spite of, you know, his liberality, you know, in paying for such fine works of art for the Order of St. John, emphasizing this communal space for the knights, because this is, after all, where all the knights would gather for chapters general, for example. In spite of that, de La Cassière had tried to initiate a number of measures that proved hugely unpopular, and he ended up being called to Rome. The main instigator of the revolt was also called to Rome. Both died in Rome. And then it was up to his successor, Hugues Lubin de Verdal, to pick up the pieces and once more try to consolidate now the Order of St. John organizationally, politically, financially. But Verdal used his cultural upbringing to great effect, because Verdal was the first Grand Master who made a conscious effort now to harness art and architecture more effectively to regenerate the identity of the Order of St. John, though through his own identity as its leader, and I shall be showing you how. Unfortunately, we don't have many portraits of Verdal, in spite of what I've just been telling you, but this is one portrait that's important because it shows Verdal in his clothing as a cardinal. A few years after being elected Grand Master, Hugues Lubin de Verdal was given the cardinalate, and he's the only Grand Master who actually got to leave Malta after being elected to the magistracy. And it's said that Verdal effectively ceded his personal authority, his personal identity as a leader of St. John by sort of aligning himself with the Pope, effectively showing how he needed papal support. Okay, in showing himself clothed as a cardinal, in effect, he was emphasizing now that he had the papal blessing in his role. But it's also been said that Verdal used that standing amongst the Knights of St. John to establish his own authority amongst them. And being made a cardinal was something that was a very hard act to follow. So it was rather effective. He was made Grand Master in 1582 and reigned for a very long time. So there must have been a measure of success in that. It's still not yet clear whether Verdal was really continuing on Lacassière's plans for the palace, or whether these are now entirely his own ideas. But we can see that with Verdal, we're getting back now, harking back to the values, to the uses of architecture, art and architecture, that were first established by the Dukes of Burgundy over 100 years earlier. These were, after all, lessons that had been long learnt by other rulers of Europe. In establishing, we do know, for example, that Verdal extended the magistral apartments, the private apartments now, on this side of the palace, and called them the summer wing. Possibly he extended the apartments on that side, which were then termed the winter wing. Did the Grand Master really need two wings in a palace? In effect, yes, and Verdal put them to good use, because in extending the halls in the palace, effectively, Verdal was following the lesson of François I Valois, in the sense that with each room leading on to the Grand Master's private quarters, access was then successively, slowly, limited to those few people who would be allowed into the private chambers of the Grand Master. So in this way, Verdal articulated the sense of privilege about progressing into the halls of the palace. So even in having a winter wing and a summer wing, Verdal certainly went to town now with the embellishment of the halls on this side, because that culminated in one of the most beautiful private chapels that we know and that I'm about to show you. Before I leave the slide, though, perhaps I should add that the corridors, as we're seeing them today, are really an 18th century structure. It's very likely that those corridors were for a long time exposed to the elements. They may have started out as terraces, shortly after maybe roofed over in the form of a loggia, and then probably several years later then closed in with windows. We know that this is what happened, for example, with Palazzo Farnese, and it's very likely to have happened even over here. So the passage into the different rooms of the magistral chambers actually occurred from one room into the other in the sort of enfilade principle. For example, if one had to open the doors over here at this end, at both ends of this room, you'd see that there are other doors behind that. So you have this sense, if once all the doors are open, you've got this sense of vista drawing you in now to the other halls. Of course, only if you are privileged enough to be able to enter them. For servants, another area that's still waiting to be researched now is how servants arrived at different halls. Now, different plans, different times of the palace show us different spiral staircases at times. So very likely, spiral staircases were what servants used to commute between the ground floor and the piano nobile. The ground floor, after all, was where the kitchens were, where the main services, if you like, were carried out. The laundry, the stables were at the back, and so on. There's actually quite a community living around the palace. We think of the Grand Master only as living here. He actually was surrounded by quite a group of people. Chances are, though, that for a long time, he was the only person who actually slept here, besides his servants. Because we know that although the pages were part of his court, of his entourage, the pages had their own residence outside the palace. Similarly, grand crosses and balises had their own palatial residences outside in other parts of Valletta. But if you study the architecture, we start getting away now of how spaces were used, how a lifestyle, if you like, unfolded in the first decades of this palace's Renaissance life. At the end of the summer wing of the halls built by Grand Master Verdal, there culminated now the most beautiful chapel of all. We tend to call this chapel the Palladini Chapel, because Palladini, Filippo Palladini, was the artist who actually embellished it with the frescoes that we're seeing in it today. But really, there's a magnificent ceiling there, a wooden ceiling built on sort of Venetian High Renaissance principles. But rather fortunately for Verdal discovered that around 1587, there was this artist, this Tuscan artist, languishing in one of the galleys of the Order of St. John in the Grand Harbour. It so happened that Filippo Palladini, who was already quite a famous artist, even in Tuscany, in his native Tuscany, he was a member of the Academy over there, for example, just one detail, had fallen foul of the Duke of the Medici, who then imprisoned him, or sentenced him, to 3 years of rowing in the galleys of the Duke. We're not quite clear how, but after 2 years, Palladini ended up in one of the galleys of the Order of St. John, that's naturally ended up in the Grand Harbour. So, possibly on the advice of one of his knights, possibly Antonio Martelli, or perhaps even Francesco dell'Antella, who had just arrived in Malta, he may have heard that there was this excellent Renaissance artist languishing. Vidal tried to negotiate Palladini's freedom, but he certainly managed to get him off the galley and into the palace. And he got Palladini to decorate this chapel with the frescoes that we're seeing in the upper tier of the room as we're seeing it here. Now, again, trying to understand what Vidal was trying to achieve, I think Vidal was probably realizing that the chapel, the magnificence of the chapel on its own, would allow him to have his own guests to join him at Mass, and possibly that's the splendor, if you like, of the way in which the chapel itself was decorated was intended probably for a larger audience than just himself. We know also that the chapel was embellished with a musician's gallery, and that's a gallery we're seeing right there, to my right. That gallery was once inside the Palladini Chapel. It was removed in the 19th century, and then later on brought into this hall. The panels that we're seeing are very much in the style, a high Renaissance style of Palladini, but they're not by him. They show episodes from Genesis. But that was the gallery on which musicians stood and sang. So there's a whole, if you like, performance going on that went on inside the chapel itself, okay? There's not just the rite of the Mass, which is ostensibly the most real reason for anybody to be in that hall, but there was also now the subtext of being impressed by the Grand Master's, you know, expression of magnificence, if you like, with the frescoes that embellished the palace, the chapel, even with now the musicians that would sing or play or perform. There's sort of there's this whole performative aspect now to life in the palace that also is still awaiting further attention. I'll give you a close-up of two of the frescoes. The first one I'm showing you is very large. They're all large, by the way. They're more or less the size of each one of the compositions here above our heads. And the first fresco shows now the birth, if you like, and the naming of John the Baptist. The theme of the frescoes, in fact, is the life of the Baptist. We have four compositions. The first one that we're seeing here, the second one, St. John preaching in the desert, the third one, which is the moment of the baptism, and then the fourth one, which is his death in the course of the banquet of Herod. I think they're the most typical Renaissance paintings that we have in Malta, in their composition, in the way the figures are represented, but even in the sense of that's a measure of kind of stillness in the moment that's being depicted. This is before Baroque has arrived at our shores, okay? Before we're overwhelmed by now Caravaggio's beheading of the Baptist. That takes place a good 20, 30 years later. Okay, this is what preceded the Baroque that we know in our churches and in our chapels. Another aspect about these frescoes that are so Renaissance are that, in a way, the composition itself reflects a court culture. There's a preciosity about the way the fabrics are depicted, the fact of the banquet, the riches in Herod's hall, the musicians, the bottom left, and the different figures, and even the architecture itself. It reflects a biblical moment, though, within the context of a courtly setting. That is possibly another aspect that's a Renaissance quality about this work of art. Now, Palladini was also engaged in producing the main altarpiece for this chapel. I apologize for the quality of this painting, but photograph. But it was taken a bit surreptitiously because this painting is now inside the palace of the Archbishop in Valletta. It was presented as a gift by the governor during the British period. But interestingly, this is an altarpiece now that is a first in the way it brings together the two saints that symbolize now the Order of St. John and Malta. There's a figure of St. John on the left and the figure of St. Paul on the right, in the company of the Madonna. So there again, this is in a way proof that Verdal's use for the chapel wasn't simply for his own personal expression of piety, for his own spiritual needs, but really it was a chapel to be seen and experienced and witnessed by guests who were privileged enough to be inside that chapel. Because the altarpiece isn't simply a religious work of art, it's also reflecting an ideological and political expression in uniting the figure of St. John the Baptist and St. Paul, the saint who represented Malta, if you like, since biblical times. Again, this is a lesson that was, this was a practice that was first established by the Dukes of Burgundy and was learned very quickly by other dukes, other princes, other kings and emperors in learning how to effectively govern well, in using art and architecture to symbolically to express certain ideas that would otherwise have been difficult or would have needed possibly too many words to express otherwise. So, if you like, this is, if you like, the culmination of the Renaissance values that underpin the design of this palace. Another aspect about the palace was that we also see the beginnings of a collection here. Not just a collection of works of art really, we find traces in the documentation in the 17th century. We know Alof de Wignacourt was a patron of art, of paintings especially, but it was actually Zondadari who is best known for having brought together an art collection that could compete with other art collections in palaces in Europe. Verdal, before that, had started collecting, but he started collecting antiques. What we're seeing here are actually drawings made by Jean Houel when he saw these antiques in the palace in the 18th century. But we know they were here from Verdal's time because they're described by visitors to the palace at the end of the 16th century. Michael von Heberer is one of them in his diaries describing the garden where these sculptures, the ones that you can see on the right, are displayed as part of the garden. Now, these sculptures are actually low reliefs of famous women from Punic times, of Punic women like Zenobia, Tullia, and two others. These are sculptures that still exist. They're found now at the Museum of Archaeology. You might remember for a time they were on the Piano Nobile, but now they've been removed and conserved for safekeeping. But when Verdal acquired these sculptures, they may have been acquired as a gift, or he may have sought them out. It was believed that they were antiques. And in fact, a century later, the librarian Navarro actually conducted his dissertation on these antiques, making a case for them as being original classical sculptures. But in effect, it's been proven now that they're actually 15th century copies. Okay? They're still equally important because copies, within the culture of collecting, copies were still important works of art to be found in other collections. Copies were one way for a great patron of art, of collections, to make a gift of, say, a famous painting, like a Titian, for example, making a gift of a copy of a work by Titian to his counterpart in another court in Europe. So this is just as a bit of a reminder that when we say copies and replicas, there's still a set of values to copies that we've lost now in modern times with the 20th century and especially with modernist ideas about art. The other pieces are Etruscan vases that were also part of the collection inside the palace. Now, a collection mattered. When you had halls like the wing that we've just described, the summer wing, A collection now, a private collection of paintings, was one way in which a collector would sort of fabricate one's own self-identity. It's a very Renaissance thing, this notion of building up your own self-identity, creating an identity for other people to measure you by, to value by, to understand your values and so on, and to understand even how erudite you were, okay, or how well you understood what was considered to be worthy of as treasures by one's counter, one's peers. So Verdal also realized, therefore, that the halls needed to be filled with artifacts, not simply to decorate them, but even now building up an identity of perhaps antiquarian, archaeologist. This is the time when Rome, lots of works of art are starting to be uncovered, excavated. Okay? This is also the time when medieval chapels are being excavated to see whether the original remains of saints are actually buried beneath them. So there's this activity going on that Verdal himself is trying to emulate amongst his peers himself. So this is also now, if you like, the beginning of the collection, the magistral art collection. Now, the interesting thing worth mentioning now is that the property itself had its own sort of line item within the budget of the Order of St. John. There was lo stato del magistero, the estate, if you like, the magistral estate. And grandmasters would enjoy the use of the palace, but at the end of their life, most of them would bequeath their property, their paintings, their furnishings, their tapestries, their damasks, to lo stato del magistero. So the palace should have been the one single instance of an accumulation of treasures, okay, an accumulation of decorative fabrics, fabulous tapestries and other things, furniture, that unfortunately got dispersed in the course of the 19th century. The palace, even during the French period, the sort of brief French interregnum, was always meant to be the residence of the governor. It's not likely that Napoleon's representatives emptied the palace, far from it, not in the same way that they emptied the churches. But we do know, and it's been documented and it's been discussed by others, that the palace itself underwent spoliation successively in different periods. And it's actually shown even from the inventories. Okay, we know from paintings showing the interiors of the palace from the 19th century of certain paintings, say by watercolors by Brockdorff of 1829, show certain paintings that aren't included in an inventory that was drawn up in 1823. So there are discrepancies, even in the documentation itself, on what was inside the palace. But we do know of first-hand witness accounts published in, say, L'Ordine in the 1860s, of auctions taking place even inside the palace itself. So, but this has been well documented and written about by others. So where the palace, this is just a reminder to show that the palace itself should have been gradually, you know, seen an accumulation of treasures. But I'd say that what we're seeing now is barely one-tenth of the splendor that it would have enjoyed, certainly until 1798. Just by way of reminding ourselves about Verdal's conscious self-fashioning, we do know that Verdal built also Verdal Palace, Boschetto, a hunting lodge. My attention was drawn to the fact that its design is rather similar to Caprarola, to the Palazzo Farnese in Caprarola, not in Rome, in Caprarola, the way its turrets sort of articulate the four corners. My attention was also drawn to the fact that the decoration of Caprarola includes sort of biographical frescoes around the figure of Ascanio della Cornea. And that really is the only instance to compare now the biographical murals showing the life of Verdal. This just goes to show, I mean, Verdal was rather astute in decorating his palace now with episodes now of his own life. I mean, Verdal wasn't exactly a hero who rode forth and battled in a siege, but his life was sort of marked in these moments thanks to these paintings. And it's also one instance where we could say that Verdal was really working to the inventions of the moment, artistic ideas of the moment that were unfolding even in Rome within the same few years. So it's rather forward of him to actually have used this sort of the medium of painting to establish the significance of his role, of his biography. But we should also see that this use, this harnessing of art and architecture is really creating now the persona of the Grand Master as being the representative, embodying now, if you like, the representation of the Order of St. John itself. In this own way, using the visual medium of art and architecture, Verdal is consolidating the presence of the Order of St. John itself. Organizationally, we know he also held the chapter general in Malta. He published the statutes, and even those statutes included engravings showing these episodes from his biography, his visual biography. So this is now where the first Renaissance prince now is using his own persona now to represent the order. And it seemed to have worked very well for Verdal, because following those years then, this was a lesson that was taken up by Wynyacourt, Alof de Wynyacourt, who used portraiture in a particularly effective way to communicate, to harness the visual arts as a means of communicating his pivotal role within the Order of St. John. I know this isn't the palace, but this is Verdala, of course, but it was worth, I thought, including this particular illustration of the thinking, the forma mentis of the time of Grandmaster Verdal and the way he harnessed the visual arts. One last element. I told you that the chapel was the last hall at the end of the summer wing, but in effect, the tower, the turretta, was the last, you know, building, if you like, within the compound of the palace. And I'd say we know the turretta was where the treasury of the order was held. The mint was also located, but it was also the highest point in Valletta, where one could gain sort of visual command now of the two harbours. So the tower itself was also meant to be seen sort of marking the point of the magistral palace even from the two harbours and the cities across the harbour. So here again, was Verdal emulating Renaissance towers like we see, for example, again, Palazzo Vecchio, okay? Not simply to oversee, but even to be seen. There's this sort of dual role of seeing and being seen that, again, is a very Renaissance idea that then flourishes within the Baroque period, particularly within Baroque arts. This is the oldest picture that we know of the facade of the church. The picture is actually missing, but we know it from its illustration in Elizabeth Schermerhorn's book of 1929. It shows the palace, not even with balconies, but with windows. And we're seeing the interaction between the palace and the piazza, which is, again, a very Renaissance quality. Not the aloofness of a medieval tower, a medieval castle, high up away where we know Castile is today, but, in effect, a palace that is in the heart of the city, surrounded by public squares where people could congregate and live out their lives now within view of the palace, but also seeing the palace, this constant interaction. We could say it's rather similar, if you like, to the way the new Parliament building is bang in the middle of where the masses of people would be walking in. It's where Parliament, sort of representing the governance of this island, is squarely at the centre. It's sort of, we could say that the centre has shifted slightly now towards Porta Reale again. But the thinking is probably the same. I probably haven't said half the things I plan to say, but it's time to end here. Just to recap very briefly, I hope to emphasize how the Renaissance values that underpinned the construction and lifestyle that animated this palace is really not simply Italian in origin, but even older than that, by looking at early Renaissance values that were established in Burgundy in the beginning of the 16th century and earlier. Anyway, I should stop here. Thank you.
May I be the first to ask a question?
Certainly.
Before the question, I thank you, of course, very much for the very urgent talk that you have made. But I make the mistake myself. Uh-huh. I perhaps make the mistake because every time we call them these frescoes. Are they actually frescoes or murals?
Murals.
Because we don't have frescoes in
Malta. No, these are frescoes, and even the Palladini pictures are frescoes. No, they're done with the proper base and gesso and so on. But a mural is a general term for anything that hangs on a wall. Technically, a tapestry is a mural as well. So.
But are they frescoes?
Yes, they are. The bone fresco. But the actual detail then would be finished in tempera or even in oil on a final layer. Most of these frescoes, these compositions, have been cleaned. And most of the cleaning was actually a removal of accumulations and some inventions as well. But otherwise, they're in very good condition. But there are still four more panels left to go. I'm being asked which part is the summer wing and which is the winter wing. The wing that is currently occupied by the Office of the President and will continue to be occupied by the Office of the President is what was the first residence that was established by de la Cassière, and that probably Verdal expanded on as a winter quarter. The summer wing is on this side, and we know the Ambassador's Hall, the Pages Hall, and other halls that are at the moment closed to the public, but they all lead one into the other in the enfilade principle, but they're on that side, on Archbishop Street. It's actually rather cool. I mean, I asked why did Verdal really need the summer wing, but in effect, it is a very cool part of the city, of the town, of the palace to live in. And Samuel Taylor Coleridge, for example, remarked in his diaries how relieved he was for the time that he was living inside the palace in the beginning of the 19th century to be sleeping in one of these halls on this side. So yes, there must have been a good reason for wanting a summer wing.
Thank you very much for it.
You have just listened to a talk organized by the Office of the President of Malta entitled A Renaissance Palace in the Making. This talk was delivered by Dr. Therese Vella.